I'm Joanna Shanks.
I'm Emma Taylor.
And this is Murder, She Spoke. So how are you, Emma? Happy New Year. And how was your Christmas?
Happy New Year to you too. Yeah, it was brilliant. It's fabulous to be in 2022. I think we had a bit of a break from everyone. So hello, everyone. Happy New Year. Hope you had a great time. But back to it. Back with a bang. How about you?
Yeah, absolutely great. Well rested and had a great time. But now I'm just full swing, ready for a brand new year. And just, yeah, I feel really positive and looking forward to this year. Looks like it's going to be quite a productive one. So yeah, feeling good.
Awesome. We had a couple of amazing reviews over the festive period, which cheered us up. Although yes. We have to say something. Something kind of hilarious happened first. So we had a not so nice review, from someone, and we're not laughing at this because we do take them seriously and they obviously mean a lot to us. But the title of the review was 20 minutes of waffling about TV shows, which I just love. That's just brilliant. So this person was looking to research a particular death and didn't like us chatting. So it is what it is. Like we've said before, it's the format of the show. A lot of people listen to us and have done from the start, so they know the chat's there. But I appreciate if you're maybe just looking for like a solo host, or you don't like the chat or whatever, maybe it's not for you. But I don't know, I'm just the kind of person, you don't like it, that's fine. It's, you know, it's a free podcast, you can just move on to something else.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than take time out of your day to
post a review. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I kind of felt the same way, to be honest. I think, we've put a lot of effort and content out over coming up for 2 years now. Mm. We both have pretty demanding day jobs, and this certainly is like a second job.
Yeah.
So we have to have a little bit of fun with it, and the cases can be sometimes, it can get to you.
So we do
try and keep it light, and sometimes we just have to have a little bit of light relief. So I'm sorry if you don't like the way we waffle about TV shows, but then we're clearly not for you.
I'd also like to point out that the person was trying to research a particular death and wanted to listen to us, and I just want to say, work smarter, not harder, because all of our links are in our show notes. You don't need to listen to us waffling on.
Yeah.
You can just click on the links. We've done the work for you. Just cheat your way through. It's fine. You're welcome. But yeah, for the rest of you who enjoy our waffling, thank you so much. And we did get two very, very sweet reviews. I believe off the back of us kind of saying,
what the
we
hell?
Got this review. We're not dead yeah. chuffed about it. So there was a lovely review from Noximus17, who's an Aussie who likes our chat and says that it gives listeners a bit of a glimpse into our lives, and they've binge watched everything in about 2 to 3 weeks, which is very impressive. And then Jenna M as well. Jenna has said that even the case that she's heard about, she finds out more detail and she likes the catch up and the recommendations and the chat. So thank you so much, guys. After a rubbish review, it really does give us a wee bit of a boost and makes our day when we get the nice ones. So much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
Anyway, Joanna, let's waffle about true crime. Have you got some information or recommendations or anything?
Well, so as you know, usually in December, I take a bit of a true crime hiatus. And I had been for a while anyway, because 2021 was not my friend in terms of mental health. Really had a struggle all year, to be quite honest. And the true crime element certainly can exacerbate that when you're constantly looking, reading and watching about, murders and serial killers and horrific deaths and things like that. So normally in December, I take a complete sort of true crime hiatus, which I did again last year. And it was all about the cheesy Christmas films and just absolute cheesy Christmas nonsense. So it was great. But straight into 2022, I have already watched a new programme. Not a documentary this time, it's actually a dramatisation of The Salisbury Poisonings.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yes, I saw that and I was like, I definitely want to watch that. Really good. 3-part series on Netflix. And yeah, it was good. Really enjoyed it because I remember when they happened, it wasn't actually that long ago. I didn't realize it was only 2019, pre-pandemic.
No, I didn't. Goodness.
Yeah. I was like, wow, is it really just that, you know, that's not long ago, despite the fact we've lived through a pandemic since then. But yeah, it was really good. I really enjoyed it. And Rafe Spall, I quite like Rafe Spall. He's in it. Yeah, so I would recommend it. What about you?
Yes, so I do actually have one that we watched the other night. So it's a film and it's called A is for Acid. I don't know if you've heard of it. Yes, it's I'm reading this off of the webpage. It's a 2002 British television film based on the life of serial killer George Haig. So it actually stars Martin Clunes. It's got Keely Hawes in it and some other people in it as well. And it was really good. It was on ITV and Richard recorded it. But basically he murdered a bunch of people in the 1940s and dissolved their bodies in acid. And then from one of them, he assumed their personality, their identity and sold properties out from under them and that sort of thing. And then basically he was finally caught when the last one didn't dissolve properly and found human fat and bits of her in, I think it was the back garden. So previously in the flat that he'd been in, he had a kind of a workshop and he had a drain. So they would all go down the drain. But this last one, he was interrupted and it you know, he didn't have enough time to do it. And she was elderly and her friend was looking for her. So when they raised the suspicions, because it happened that much, he wasn't that smart. He was always going to get caught, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. They found parts of her. So yeah, really interesting. Martin Clunes is actually really good in it. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's set in the 40s. There's, you know, info about the war and everyone's got the really right, what's the word I'm looking for? The correct clothing for that period of time.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
I wasn't trying to say like pure jamba, but you know what I mean? Everything's of the 1940s. So it's got that kind of vibe. So yeah, that was really good. And I'm sure you can get it on catch up.
Actually, that's quite interesting because Martin Clunes played Colin Sutton in Manhunt. On ITV.
So, yes.
So I wondered if it was going to be a Colin Sutton one, but clearly not if it's in the 40s. So yeah, interesting. And I really liked the part that he played when he played Colin Sutton. I thought he did a really good job. So yeah, I'm going to check that out. What channel did you say that's on?
So we saw it on ITV and I reckon you can get it on the kind of ITV player catch-up-y kind of things. Yeah.
Fab.
You should be able to get it there.
So what is your case? I'm so excited to get back into this because it's been ages since we recorded. And I'm ready for you to tell me all about a new case today.
Yeah, no, it's exciting. It's nice to be in a new year with a new case. This is a case from 1973, so you might not have heard of it. And it's the case of Margaret McLaughlin. Ring any bells?
No.
Okay, that's fine. In 1973, Margaret McLaughlin, she was 23 years old and she worked as a typist and she was living with her family in Glenburn Terrace in Carluke, which is a small town in Lanarkshire. So that's about 23 miles away from Glasgow, just if people aren't aware of where that would be. She had recently gotten engaged to her fiancé, who was called Bob Alexander, and he was working in South Africa for the summer that year. Margaret was a dark-haired, attractive young woman with a slight build who was described as quiet, exceptionally thoughtful and honest. They were due to be married in October of that year, after Bob had proposed on her 22nd birthday. On Friday, the 6th of July, 1973, Margaret had planned to go into Glasgow by train to discuss wedding planning with her soon-to-be sister-in-law. Apparently, they were going to pick out wedding invitations because Bob was away, so they wanted to get on with the planning. She had intended to take a train shortly after 8 p.m, so she left her home at 8 minutes to 8 and took a shortcut to the train station through a green area, which was a glen known as the Colonel's Glen. It's just kind of like a wooded area with a path going through it that people would, that would be the shortcut that they would take. Mm-hmm. As you may expect, Margaret did not make her train. The following day, which was actually the day of the Carluke Highland Games, the body of Margaret McLaughlin was found halfway down the railway embankment on one side of the glen. So these are, it's like really steep kind of foliage rich green embankments on either side. Yeah.
Typical.
Yeah, exactly. There's loads of these in Scotland. If you live here, you've probably walked through a million of them. So her clothing was wet due to the rain the previous night. She lay on her back with her hair spread out, her head facing down towards the bottom of the glen. Her arms were above her head and her clothes were in disarray as though she'd been dragged to the spot that she was found.
Right.
She had been stabbed 19 times to her arms, face, neck, abdomen and her back, and she had bruises to her face.
Oh God.
Yeah. There were blood spots around her on the ground and in the foliage. There was no sign of sexual assault. So the police followed the blood spots to the top of the glen and they believe that that's where the initial stabbing took place. They actually found a knife which had been pushed hilt deep into the ground, which was really strange. It was next to a concrete post and there were also some red fibres on the post as if it had come from clothing of some sort. So they did quite a bit of analysis of the scene. Further along the path towards the railway station, they found a patch of flattened grass. So as if people had been scuffling or something had, you know, people had trodden on it or something along those lines. And one of Margaret's rings was found right next to that patch of grass. Interestingly, it wasn't her engagement ring, which was what they expected because that was worth quite a bit. She still had her engagement ring on. It was a pinky ring that she wore. A gold charm bracelet was also missing from Margaret. They found a bent umbrella, which might have been used in a fight at the top of the glen as well. And then further down the glen from where Margaret was found, they found her handbag and her suitcase. So they were both closed when they were found, but it looked like they had been opened possibly, but no obvious items were missing. Mm-hmm. Additionally, where they were found, the police didn't think that the murderer could have thrown the case, for example, and they would have had to carry it to where it was found.
Right. And can I just check, when she left 8 minutes to eight, that I'm assuming that was in the morning, yeah?
No, it was in the evening.
Oh, it was at night, sorry. Right,
okay. Yeah. Did you have other questions?
No, that was it.
No, you're fine. Yeah.
Because okay, in my head, I was thinking in the morning, maybe daylight, that's strange. It makes more sense.
She left in the evening. She was actually planning on getting the same train as her sister, who was going into Glasgow as well, but she spent too long packing her bag, basically. So she ended up getting a different train from her. And she was going to stay with the sister-in-law, which is why she had the bag. So she had a suitcase. Right. As well with her. Just a small one, but you know, a suitcase with her.
An overnight case.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They didn't find any footprints at the crime scene, which was a little bit unusual because I don't think it was a paved path. You know, it was just a path that people used to cut through.
Yeah.
And the grass was wet, so you would expect that, but they didn't find that. They did find human hairs on her clothes, on the front of her clothing. She was lying on her back and they found hairs on her clothing and they found blood under her fingernails. No blood was found on the knife, which was retrieved from beside the concrete post.
Interesting. Was there a burn or anything nearby, or did it not say?
It didn't say anything about a burn.
Okay.
Not that, because normally, I know what you're saying, normally in these kind of glens there usually is, but it didn't say anything about it.
You know,
she wasn't close by and all her things were kind of found close to her, apart from that gold bracelet that was missing.
Yeah. Just for anyone who doesn't know, a burn would be like a small body of water.
Like a stream.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So the police spoke to the McLaughlin family and they told them that Margaret, like I said, had originally intended on taking an earlier train with her sister, but then she took too long to pack her case. So she was aiming for that 8:03 train and she left at 8:08 and she was spotted by several locals and neighbours as she left her home to walk to the station. William Munsey, who I believe we have mentioned before, who was a senior murder detective at that time, was in charge of the investigation and he made a statement to the press. He said, quote, "I feel some household must have noticed someone arriving home with signs of murder on his person. In kindness to that family, I appeal to them to come forward. It may well be that the killer needs attention and he could strike again," end quote. So that's something that will come up a little bit later as well. It was an overkill murder.
Right.
There was no need for the 19 separate stab wounds, and it would have been very messy for the person who had committed the murder. As the police commenced their investigation, they could not find anyone who had a grudge against or an issue with Margaret, and her fiancé was not even in the country. Obviously, as we know, generally in these circumstances, they would look to the romantic partner as a suspect. However, obviously, Bob was not even in the country at the time.
Yeah.
They continued their interviews, and one local man piqued their interest. This was 19-year-old George Beatty. He told police that he had passed through the Glen at around the time of the murder, on his way to buy tomatoes at a local plant nursery, to take to some colleagues at the steelworks where he was employed. Another local man spotted Beatty around this time and confirmed that he was in the Glen around 8 p.m. So George Beatty was described as an odd character, somewhat of a fantasist and a teller of tall tales. He was described as a big softy who wouldn't hurt a fly, but he did make up these weird and wonderful stories to kind of to show off. Mm-hmm. So Bill Munsey, William Munsey, the detective from before, so he was a very famous officer at the time, and he had 100% conviction rate for murder cases.
Wow.
And this was to be his 54th murder case and the last one before his retirement.
Oh, right, okay.
Just to frame that for you. Mm-hmm. He was convinced that George Beatty was the murderer, and he brought George in for questioning. They also took him to the Glen and asked him to retrace his steps. So this was on the Tuesday after the murder. They took him to the Glen. It was still set up with all the markers for the crime scene. So like mm-hmm. things were cordoned off, and it was quite obvious where things had been, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. They took him to the top of the embankment, walked him past all these different parts that were cordoned off, and asked a lot of quite specific questions. Mm-hmm. The following day, Beatty was interrogated at length and eventually gave a bizarre account. He stated he'd been in the Glen and he was grabbed by three men wearing top hats with mirrors on, who made him watch as three other men stabbed Margaret to death.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was interrogated at length by several detectives as well, which I don't know how that would stand up today. Mm-hmm. He also correctly identified items that were inside Margaret's suitcase, which was closed when it was found. So that was a big red flag for them. How did he know that it was like specific items of clothing and the colour of them. Mm-hmm. So they were really suspicious about that. But some of the interviewing detectives didn't know that George had been shown the scene of the crime at that point. So mm-hmm. they just thought, how do you know some of this information?
Yep. And if they fed that information to him, then...
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. So they then took him back to the scene of the crime, I believe it's the following day again, so this be the Wednesday, and he pointed out the various points of like where she was stabbed, and then the scuffling, flattened grass, and where her body had lain. So he gave this very detailed account of what happened, but he didn't claim that he had done it, but he did know all this information, mm-hmm. so they arrested him. They checked for forensic evidence on George Beatty and in his home. He had no scratches, bruises, or any other marks on him. No other evidence was found except for a single spot of blood on a handkerchief in his pocket, which was the same blood type as Margaret's. So there was like three handkerchiefs in his pocket on the day where he was interviewed with police, and when they took it, there was one single drop of blood, and it was, I believe, type O rhesus positive. I might have gotten that wrong. However, that actually matched 43% of the population.
Yeah, it's the most common blood type, I think.
Yeah.
Because I'm O positive, and it's, mm-hmm. yeah, one of the most common.
Yeah. So 43% was the quote given at the time. However, they honed in on this fact that he had a drop of, you know, supposedly Margaret's blood, or it, you know, it could have been Margaret's blood, why you would have just one drop of it and then keep it on a handkerchief and then put it in your jacket and then go to the police station with that in your pocket is beyond me. But anyway, So they had arrested him and it went to trial. The court trial lasted for 3 days and evidence included the knife from the crime scene, which had no fingerprints or blood on it, and there was no forensic evidence tying it to either Margaret or George. However, it could be said to have been the type to make the wounds found on Margaret, so it did match the stab wounds. However, all they needed to prove is that it was over 4 inches long, really, for that to be the case.
Yeah, maybe like serrated or not serrated.
Exactly, exactly. So tenuous at best. Mm-hmm. George Beattie did not testify in court, and he had his lawyer tell the court the police made up the account of the men in the top hats and the whole story. Nevertheless, George Beattie was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison.
I don't like this.
Yeah. George Beattie spent 13 years in prison before his release in 1986. Beattie's case became the subject of a BBC Rough Justice documentary, while late Labour MP Jimmy Hood campaigned to overturn the conviction, but 3 separate court appeals were unsuccessful.
Wow, okay.
During George's trial, his family believed that evidence was withheld from the jury and that his defence failed to raise crucial points that would have stopped him from being convicted. His sister Georgina has gone on the record saying, quote, "There was just so many things that were wrong, so many questions left unanswered, and I think as a family it just totally floored us. I suppose we never really healed because it's always there in the back of your mind. The police weren't worried, they had got an easy target and he was going to be the one that they were going to convict. Common sense would have told you the way this girl was murdered, he must have been covered in blood. There was nothing on him." End quote.
Yeah.
There's more.
Okay.
Interestingly, Margaret McLaughlin's fiancé Bob also doesn't believe that George killed her.
Okay.
Bob's now 72 and lives in Giffnock. He has recently spoken out to STV News about the case. So I'll read you what he said. Quote, "I have absolutely no doubt now that George Beattie did not commit that murder. At that time, you just fully accept the police have done their job and he must be the guilty party. We were told that there was quite compelling evidence, so you accept that." End quote. He also was not impressed by Detective Bill Munsey. So he said, quote, "After a brief discussion, which was less than a minute with him, I came away with the impression that William Munsey was such an arrogant, pompous individual. He was actually saying to myself he would actually have this case resolved in a very short time. And he did. He got the wrong man." Mm-hmm. "I think that this is the last opportunity for this to be investigated. It's really difficult for the police to reopen this case, but it's the correct thing to do because it's compelling, the evidence that this trial was wrong and that George Beattie couldn't have done this. George Beattie didn't do this. The policing now is so different to what it was in the 70s and I think it would do their credibility a lot of good to do this now." End quote. So that's her fiancé who's saying that.
Yeah, and which says a lot.
Yeah. So he wants Police Scotland to re-examine the case for George Beattie, for Margaret, obviously, and for both their families, because there's a lot of stigma in Carluke. George Beattie's sister was saying that as well, that, you know, you walk down the street and it's, oh, that's that, you know, that George Beattie's family, he murdered Margaret McLaughlin. You know, it's the classic small town kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you can't escape that. That's why people move away a lot of the time after these sort of things. So Bob was actually prompted to speak out because he read a book by the criminologist Professor David Wilson.
Birmingham University?
Exactly. Signs of Murder, it's called. And in that book, he re-examines the entire case and he claims to have identified a much more likely suspect for Margaret's murder.
Interesting.
Yes. So Professor Wilson grew up in Carluke.
Did he?
He did, yeah.
I didn't know that. I knew he was Scottish, but I didn't know he grew up in Carluke.
Yeah, so like anyone would be, if something happens in your hometown, he was very aware of Margaret's case. And he had been a criminologist for decades and it'd been something that he wants to revisit. And I believe he knows the family So he decided to look into it further. He did say that he was always a bit concerned that he might possibly come to the same conclusion that the police did and that the court mm-hmm. did, and then he would be letting the family down. Mm-hmm. However, he started looking into it and he was soon convinced that a miscarriage of justice had definitely taken place. Mm-hmm. So I'll just go over the main points from him. Mm-hmm. There was absolutely no forensic evidence to connect George Beattie to the murder. Additionally, as Bill Munsey himself had stated in the press statement he gave, the murderer would have had signs of murder on them. George had no blood, wounds, torn clothing, or any other signs of violence upon him. He had no mud on him, and he had no undergrowth or foliage on him either. In the BBC Rough Justice documentary, they did a reenactment of how long it would have taken for someone to commit the murder from George Beattie leaving his house, and then he actually went to work after he went to that plant nursery. Mm-hmm. And it would have been very, very difficult for him to do it. Additionally, the man that did the reenactment came out completely covered in burrs and right. other bits of foliage and mud, completely covered. And that's notwithstanding the blood that would have been everywhere.
Yeah.
So multiple people would actually saw him on his way to work after leaving the plant nursery, and the man that served him at the nursery, sold him the tomatoes, he said he was totally calm, not a speck on him of anything, not bothered about anything, just, you know, normal.
Completely normal.
Exactly. And he would have had to run full pelt to get there, and he would have been covered in all these things, and he wasn't covered in them. No one saw anything on him, and at work no one saw anything on him. So what about his secret knowledge of the scene? Assessing the information shared by the press, at the time, it wasn't secret information. There was an right. aerial photograph of the scene on the front page of the newspaper, which showed the location of Margaret. It told you about the wounds that she had, how many wounds she had, what happened to her, what she was wearing, and much, much more information. Also, one side of the glen wasn't secured, it wasn't sealed off. So people were able to go and stand at that side of the glen and look down onto the crime scene before everything had been cleared away.
Right.
So there could have been locals who saw the contents of the suitcase and any other details that were going on.
Yeah. Whatever they liked, really.
Exactly.
Just a window exactly. into what was going on.
Yeah, no, they were just, you could just stand and look down and see it all. So that's not secret knowledge, I wouldn't argue, especially in a small town. That's mm-hmm. going to spread like wildfire. People
oh, yeah.
are going to talk to each other in church, in the pub, you know, in the street. You know, did you hear, oh, apparently they found a suitcase and this was in it and that was in it. You know what it's like.
Yeah.
So that was the information that he was giving them. However, some of the detectives didn't take that into account and took it as in he had secret knowledge of the scene. Additionally, in George Beattie's reported confession, you know, the one with the men in top hats, mm-hmm. With mirrors on the top hats, never seen one like that, but that's interesting. He identified the knife in the ground as the murder weapon. There was no blood found on that knife. There was no forensic mm-hmm. evidence found on that knife. And it was discounted almost immediately as they basically said it could not have been the murder weapon, and yet they still chose to go with it. So Professor Wilson consulted a worldwide expert in false memories, Professor Elizabeth Loftus, who I have heard of before. I can't remember where, but I have heard, that's ironic considering she deals with memories, but I am aware of her, and she is a renowned expert. Mm-hmm. She read over all the information, presented with all the evidence. She has no doubt that Beattie made his confession up. Professor Wilson did so much research on this. He looked at the routes of where Margaret walked and the timings, and he worked out which street the killer would likely have lived on due to the timings, the route of Margaret that night, etc., etc. He then spoke with a retired officer from the investigation. So this retired officer was a detective called Bob Beveridge. And he had assisted the police with the house-to-house inquiries for the investigation. In his words, he encountered the most extraordinary person he'd ever interviewed. So, this man jumped off his sofa, pulled up his shirt, to reveal scratches on his stomach and claim that he'd been attacked too. He then went on to tell Bob Beveridge that he always carried a knife as he liked to stab cats in the local area. Bob asked him if he'd killed Margaret. The man said, he might have done, but he couldn't remember what he'd done yesterday. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
This was obviously, 40-odd years ago.
Yeah.
So Bob couldn't remember exactly where the man lived, the number of the sheep, but he drew a map of Carluke and the area, and it was the same street of houses that Professor David Wilson had already identified, and he remembered the specific house, and it matched up with rumours and hearsay and things like that that other people had said about a particular person.
Okay.
So he spent a good amount of time tracking down the man. So at the time, he was unnamed in the book, and he came away more convinced than ever that this was the true killer of Margaret McLaughlin.
Okay.
In the first version of the book, Professor Wilson names the man as John Smith, just as a, you know, as a pseudonym.
Alias.
Exactly. However, upon his passing, he has actually released the identity of the man, and his name was Les Jardin.
Okay.
So the new edition of the book will be updated accordingly. Les Jardin spent time in a Lanarkshire psychiatric hospital for some time, and he was rumoured to be dead or living in Canada. However, Professor Wilson tracked him down to Aberdeenshire and he spoke with him. And initially, Les Jardin apparently just said, no, George Beattie did it, George Beattie did it, George Beattie did it, and then wouldn't really talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, I think he basically more or less accused him of having done it. And he said, well, I don't really know what happened, and just shut the door in his face. But he said everything about his countenance and the way he held himself and just everything about it, him, he was very suspicious that he believes that that's who the real killer of Margaret McLaughlin was.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, quote, I'm never going to be able to prove beyond reasonable doubt who killed Margaret, but I do believe I've been able to demonstrate beyond reasonable doubt that Beattie did not kill Margaret.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So that's where it's at the minute, the case. Professor Wilson has been looking to raise the profile of the case, so I thought it'd be interesting for us to cover it as well.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion matches Professor Wilson's, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily know that this Les Jardin was the person that did it. It seems that, you know, some of the facts fit very, very clearly. But then also, if he spent time in a psychiatric hospital, he would also be an easy person to kind of
pin it on,
you know. And if he says things like, stabbing cats and stuff like that, that feels very fitting and apt. Doesn't necessarily mean that he did it, but I would agree that with Professor David Wilson that it would appear that there may have been a miscarriage of justice with regards to George Beattie. And unfortunately, his mother passed away after years of campaigning and trying to get the record set straight and get him pardoned or his conviction overturned.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, she never saw that happening. But it's a fascinating case.
Mm.
So what do you think? I'd like to hear your thoughts.
I don't think I've heard of the case. I don't think I've heard of Margaret McLaughlin. I don't think I've heard of George Beattie. So it was all sort of brand new to me. But yeah, really intriguing. So presumably George Beattie is, you said he's still in prison and he's been there for how many years?
No, he was released after 13
years.
Oh,
yes. Yes, sorry. He was released after 13 years. Yes, sorry.
But you always have that following you around, don't you, if you've got a murder conviction?
That's it. He's still got the conviction. Just because he's not in prison anymore doesn't mean that, you know, his life's fine and dandy. Yeah, God, that's, not one that I knew about. So really interesting. And like you say, it's worthwhile covering it if, you know, David Wilson's trying to raise the profile of it.
I think we have to state, obviously, for the record and for legal reasons, that, you know, George Beattie is legally classified legally guilty. You know, he's legally guilty, and he was convicted of the murder of Margaret McLaughlin. However, the information that we've given today, which you can read about more in David Wilson's book. I do recommend it. He's a very interesting person and he's done a huge amount of research. It will take you a lot longer to read than it would to listen to this, though. So if you're quite happy with this, that's fine. But it's called Signs of Murder. And obviously, the most up-to-date version will have Liz Jardine's name in it. So you can go, you can have a look, you can let us know what you think. It just feels off, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. God, that's such a shame. Yeah, for Margaret's family as well. And the fact that her fiancé, you know, also believes that the person who spent time in prison for her murder isn't guilty. That's just awful. Yeah, it's just terrible all
for
around.
For me, that's really telling. I believe Margaret's family have been loath to comment.
Right.
Which I understand. And do you know, I think you would find it really difficult because you felt like you had closure and now maybe you don't have closure. So I can understand why you would be happier to keep accepting that a specific person had done it and not necessarily want to look at alternative options. But it must be really difficult for George Beattie's family. Apparently his mother just could not believe it. She was just lost her mind when they came to see George has admitted to the murder, which, as we said, he didn't even admit it. But they kept saying that that was an admission of guilt because he was there and he was claiming, even though the story was outlandish and outrageous, they were claiming that that was him saying, oh, you know, I was there and this happened.
See, as soon as you said 100% conviction rate, 100% success rate, I was like, does any police detective have 100% success rate?
Sure, if you just pick who did it. And...
yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that already raised my suspicions.
Yeah, so from what Professor Wilson has said, from what Bob and Margaret's fiancé has said and others, they firmly believe that Bill Munsey was pinning it on someone because he wanted to get a conviction and this suited his narrative and that suited what he wanted to happen. And that's basically what transpired. He said George Beattie's done it and he was convicted. And when you look back at the evidence, I mean, they put so much importance on this nonsensical story that he gave them, the information that he knew, the secret information, which wasn't secret, exactly, and the spot of blood in the handkerchief.
Yeah. The whole thing's just, I mean, that's it. I mean, forensics would obviously hinder probably his success rate these days if he was still an active police officer.
There was a note on one of the accounts that I read, and I don't know how factual that is, so take this with a pinch of salt, it's why I didn't include it, but the hair found on Margaret and the blood that was found under her fingernails has still never been tied to an individual.
Interesting.
But I don't believe they ever took Les Jardine's DNA.
And also, do they even still have that evidence?
Highly unlikely.
They probably destroyed it as soon as they got a conviction.
Yeah.
If not before. You know what I mean? It was the 70s.
Yeah,
DNA wasn't.
Yeah.
It was in its infancy, wasn't it? So,
but they didn't even blood type the blood under
fingernails
at first, I don't think.
What did George Beattie do for a job?
He worked in steelworks.
Right, okay.
So he was there for a shift and people saw him.
An alibi.
Well, that's basically what David Wilson's saying. He's saying the timings as well. He likely would have already been at work when she was actually murdered.
Yeah. Did it make mention of, did he have a low IQ by any possibility or?
I believe he was not the brightest.
Yeah. Yeah. So it would have been very easy for him to be coerced by police if they wanted to do that.
Absolutely. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily what we would call an ethical interrogation nowadays. I think there was pressure and I think he was under a lot of stress. And he was
just
already,
different tactics.
Yeah, he was already a teller of tall tales and he came up with this utterly mad tale and they just jumped
on it. Or did he?
Or did he? Exactly. He claims that the police made it up and that they, you know, made him see things. And I wasn't there, but from everything that we're finding out now, I mean, could be right. So yeah, so that is the very sad case of Margaret McLaughlin. Because it was so long ago, I don't have huge amounts of information about Margaret herself, or I would have told you more about her. But she, to be honest, she seemed quite quiet and diligent, lived with her family, obviously madly in love with her fiancé Bob, and they were looking forward to getting married. And she just looks lovely in her picture. There's pictures of his going away party and they just look very lovely together. So it's just terribly sad overall. But yeah, read the book and let us know what you think, guys. We'd really appreciate it.
And she was going into Glasgow to do the wedding invitations and things. Yeah. So she was kind of in the throes of planning her wedding as well, which is, yeah, it's sad. Just such a shame. Yeah, definitely. Well, that was a really interesting case. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for covering it.
No worries. Do you have a fun true crime fact or story for us?
Okay, so the story I've got was that, I mean, obviously it's not funny that the man got beaten up, but the reason the man got beaten up was because some thugs asked to try his top hat on and he refused to let them. So apparently this gang of thugs beat up a man in a top hat because he refused to let them try it on. The fancily dressed commuter was waiting for a train at Catford Bridge when he was approached by a group of men on February 28 shortly after 10 p.m. They asked if they could try on his top hat, but the victim declined. He then got on board a train destined for Charing Cross. A man approached him again and there was a disagreement, police said. The victim was assaulted and left with facial injuries. His top hat was also stolen.
Oh, what a rubbish ending. I was hoping he'd at least get the bloody hat back.
So, yeah. So, no, I mean, it's mean, but do you know what? It's kind of one of those things, isn't it?
Were they drunk?
Probably. I mean it's like if you know you're going to go out dressed for Halloween or something and you're like, oh, my God, you were in a costume or something. And you're like, everyone's going to try and nick it or everyone's going to try and ask to try it on. Yeah. That kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I get it.
That's why you get 10 top hats stopped, like stacked on top of the other one, but they get progressively smaller. So, like... like a Russian doll until you've just got like a miniature top hat on your head. You just keep taking them off. That's what you need to do.
Thank you so much for listening. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating or review. If you want to get in touch with us with any funny true crime related tidbits, stories or facts that you want us to read out at the end of the show, please contact us info@murdershespoke.net. And if you just fancy saying hello, you can reach us on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter. Thanks so much and we'll see you next week.